KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. We're on Twitter at KUOW, as always. But we're going to do something a little bit different today. We will spend the hour with one of my favorite people in the ever, but especially in the Northwest, an astute local observer and writer, author, crosscut columnist, the Mossback, Knute Berger. Always good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Well, great to see you, Bill. Fun to be here.
Yeah, well, we're gonna take you through the news together. We've got a lot of stuff to touch on going on in the world, in our little corner of the world today. First of all, it's Election Day, where we don't go to the polls. So you could be standing in line in the sunshine right now, staring at your phone like everybody else and waiting to cast your Democratic birthright. But what else can you do except we just sit and wait for the results of people's dropping in the box?
Yeah, it's interesting because I've never liked the summer primary, which, we used to have the primary after Labor Day.
Mm-hmm.
So I can understand why a lot of people don't turn out.
Why did we change back to a summer primary?
Oh, heck if I know.
Yeah.
But I think people felt it was too little time between the general election and a September primary. And there's some discussion about getting it out of summer because there's certainly a long tradition of people here just tuning out of politics between Memorial Day and Labor Day.
Why do we do that, really? Is it just because we've been told so many times, no one cares about politics in the summer? I mean, what is so vastly different about the summer that we can't bring ourselves to fill in a few ovals for the good of our democracy?
The weather, I don't know. I mean, people like to get out of town and that kind of
thing. Yeah, true.
And, you know, we've made it incredibly easy with mail-in voting. Although a lot of people don't know what a postage stamp is anymore, so I suppose that's an inhibiting factor.
Right. You know, I've read that some counties and states that do the mail-in voting, they'll mail you your ballot, and then they'll use that same means, the USA mail, to send you reminders. Hey, you know, fill in your ballot. But I don't think we do that here, right? I never get a reminder.
Yeah, I don't think so.
I mean,
you get tons of mail from candidates.
Yes.
And
that's true. That's a kind of reminder.
Everybody wants more junk mail, right?
Right.
Those giant things that they jam into your mailbox.
Yes.
Yeah.
So turnout is going to be roughly a third of King County voters, something like that?
Yeah.
Maybe a little over?
Looks like it's on track in the mid-30s, 36%, something like that. And you know, that's interesting particularly looking at the mayor's race in Seattle. You've got tons of candidates, mm-hmm. got 21 candidates. And so a relatively tiny percentage of people are going to be making a big decision here. And that's one of the fascinating aspects is that a couple thousand votes either way can determine, which candidates get through.
Right. And we don't often know because we have a 8 p.m. deadline you have the daily postmark by today deadline. You've got the drop-off deadline. So we get votes in so late, we may not know, especially with such a crowded primary. We may have no idea for quite a while who's going to get through to the mayoral race.
Yeah, it depends. It depends on how it divvies up. If there are two candidates that are, just really get the lion's share of the vote. But going back to, 2013 or... we go back a ways. Some of these races have been really, really close, on primary night or even in the final, determined by just a couple of percentage points either way. So it's going to depend on who mobilized their base, who had the support of groups like labor, doorbelling, and getting ballots in the mail.
Do you think a low turnout gives us any worse outcome? Because we hear that, right? How it's so important that we have high voter turnout.
In city elections or in elections in general?
Either one, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, well, certainly.
You have high-interest voters, right, in those elections?
You get elections where the results are somewhat skewed by the fact that it's certain people that turn out and vote all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Older people. Well-to-do people, property mm-hmm. owners, mm-hmm. that kind of thing, people with and so you get fewer younger voters, fewer minority voters, so there's a less diverse population. I think you could make the argument that if more people voted, and even more important than voting, if more people actually paid attention to the issues and that kind of thing, you might get some better outcomes.
Yeah, what is sunny. It's beautiful outside. Who do you predict gets through in the mayoral primary?
Oh, you know, I really don't have a prediction. I mean, I think of this as kind of the Netflix election.
How's that?
And it's like, you know how you're tired after the work day and you want to watch something entertaining and you go to Netflix and you see all these choices, but none of them really satisfies, you know? Mm-hmm. You're kind of, and this was true back in the days of the video.
The video store, right? Yeah.
Yeah, the same thing. You just look at, you've got thousands of choices and suddenly you can't pull the trigger. You know, you just can't decide.
Right. You walk out with Turner and Hooch or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking, you know, Weekend at Bernie's 4, you know. And it's like, and I have not experienced a mayoral race in some years where so many people seem undecided at the last. I've been getting, you know, people have been texting me or emailing friends and family, you know, people like, who are you voting for?
My sister emailed me for the same skinny.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm down to like 4 people, but I can't choose. Part of it is that among the sort of top 6 candidates, the people who are seen particularly by the media as the most credible, most likely candidates, you know, they're all on the left. It's just a matter of left or lefter or leftist or mm-hmm. or off the rails, you know, and
says you.
And yeah. And so but many of the distinctions are hard to grasp. And some of that's intentional and some of that's just they all don't like Trump. They all believe homelessness is a problem. They all and some of them as part of their strategy, you know, speak in very platitudinous terms about, you see some of these mailers that come in and it's like, I am for affordable housing. We must have more housing,
yes.
You know, kind of thing. And it's like, okay, well, yeah, but what are your specific strategies? So it's difficult to kind of parse. So you get,
while preserving what we love about Seattle.
Yes. Nothing will change, yet everything will change.
Yeah.
So, and, but we have.
You're not going to make a prediction, are you?
No, I'm not going to make a prediction. Because honestly, I really don't. I really don't know. And those small percentages could make a huge difference. So, I think in a way that makes it an exciting election.
Exciting, you know? Because of that?
Well, I think it's fun, exciting.
Yeah.
I think it's good that we don't know, that there's not an absolute sort of slam dunk. I mean, the polls, such as they are, have suggested, you know, that Jenny Durkin, Mike McGinn, you know, were kind of the top 2, but the percentages weren't great. There was a lot of undecideds. But then you look at a campaign like Nikita Oliver, a lot of enthusiasm. You know, if you're a liberal, lots of your Facebook friends like Nikita, you know, they're an enthusiasm and organization are, you know, going to be factors.
And a lot of people who watched an election in November of 2016 can never shake off the feeling that anything can happen.
Well, you know? that's a good point. They shouldn't. I mean, you know, if you want things to be a certain way, you have to go out and vote that way, you know, and not expect other people to, you know, vote for you.
We have in the middle of this, here we're talking about candidates to be the new mayor of Seattle, and that's because the current mayor is not going to do the job. And this week we had another city council member, Kshama Sawant, saying Mayor Murray should resign. Lorena Gonzalez has said that as well. But then you had 4 former mayors coming out and saying what we need is order. What did you make of all of this?
Well, it's really interesting. I can understand why people might want Ed Murray to resign, and the rationales have been that his defense of his the way that he has proclaimed his innocence has cast aspersions or shadows on victims or social workers and that kind of thing. I mean. Yet also the fact remains he's never been convicted of anything. He's never been found liable in court, in civil court. He's innocent until proven guilty. And so, you know, I think there are ways of, you know, I can understand why somebody would want him to resign, but I also understand and kind of agree with the 4 mayors that he's going to be out of office. it's better to have some continuity getting there. We're going to have a new mayor, whoever that is. You know, the sort of steadier a tiller you hand to the new person, I think the better.
And the conversation seems to be about how important it should be to have a steady tiller, and how unsteady would the tiller be if we had. So first of all, if there were a transition, it's not like we don't have rules in place to to impeach someone or to have a new mayor put a temporary mayor until an election. I mean, again, I'm not advocating for this.
Right. No. I mean, there are processes in place. I mean, you can get rid of a mayor by recall, which has been done in Seattle history in at least one instance. You can also, the council can basically remove the mayor for, there's kind of a morals clause. The objections to Murray tend to be couched in terms about his use of language. In other words, his rhetoric in his own defense. I'm not sure that would qualify as something you could remove him for. But also there's, especially if you went into, quote, impeachment mode, you know, the city council has a lot of stuff it's supposed to be doing. So it's not just, you know, the city administration, but it's, what is the council focusing on? Are they focusing on affordable housing? Are they focusing on homelessness? Are they focusing on equity, pay equity? I mean, there are all kinds of issues we want progress on there. And, you know, you're really going to impeach somebody who's only got a few months left.
Right. But the LGBTQ commission, for example, would say, well, the new mayor will get to all that. We'll get to affordability. But in the meantime, it's time to stop down and call attention to, you know, that commission is saying that the mayor's response invoking the accuser's criminal records as proof of their unreliability is just, you know, it's dismissive and it's hurtful. And they're saying this is the time to focus on that.
I agree that it's some of that language has been dismissive and hurtful, but I'm not sure it's impeachable.
You said the one there's a lot we don't know in the mayoral race, and there are plenty of other races too. At the King County arts tax is going to be quite interesting coming up. See whether that's going to get through. But a slam dunk will be that a liberal will run the city of Seattle. And that Seattleites will vote to this is some well-to-do Seattleites voting for a liberal who will raise taxes. Do you think when Seattleites vote to raise their taxes, they're voting against their self-interest?
I don't. I mean, I think that, you know, I think Nick Hanauer is sort of the go-to person on this in terms of, you know, the enlightened self-interest of capitalists to make sure everyone else does well.
Right.
You know, and the more money people have to spend, the better the system operates. So I don't think they are voting in their own against their own self-interest. I think they're voting for it. But I'm not a rich guy, so, you know, I see it. But we've certainly had plenty of Seattle wealthy people who have stood up and wanted to see the wealthy pay more taxes. Bill Gates Sr., for example, mm-hmm. led the statewide initiative to get the income tax back. So I think there are a lot of, you know, people here who think that the wealthy in town not only can pay, but would be willing to pay, and that Seattle would be better off for it. A lot of people, you know, like if the commentator at Fox News who called us a socialist hellhole.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know,
former Seattleite, I think.
Former, yeah. And, that, you know, I mean, there are people who look at it and just say, well, you're nuts. You know, any rich person who, you know, votes to raise taxes is crazy.
Yeah. What's the matter with Seattle? They vote against their self-interest.
Right. But I actually don't think they are voting
right.
against their self-interest. I think that's the point. And, you know, you're right. We will have a progressive mayor. It'd be interesting. I mean, you mentioned Prop 1. I'm interested in how Proposition 1 does.
That's the King County Arts and
King County
Cultural
Arts,
and Science
exactly.
Institution.
It's a tiny increase in the sales tax that would allow school kids to more access to all kinds of heritage and cultural institutions. I feel like, you know, that has been spun as sort of a tax for the arts. Mm. And even progressives are split on that. It's not just people who don't like taxes. I've talked to, you know, very progressive liberal friends who just, well, I do not want to see any increase in any regressive tax,
right,
includes the sales tax, or that the arts aren't a priority, homelessness is a priority, you know, that kind of thing.
Yep. I interviewed Larry Gossett from the King County Council, who was coming out against the tax.
Yeah, and I have a different view. I view it as, you know, if I were trying to sell it, I would sell it as part of basic education. You know, the state has a constitutional duty getting kids into museums or historical societies or whatever. I think there's been this focus that, oh, all these places like the art museum are going to get money that they don't need, you know, type of thing. But there's all kinds of organizations that could really benefit. But I think it's really a student education thing. But I'll be interested to see how that turns out.
You're listening to unpaid campaign consultant Knut Berger there, Crosscut columnist, the Mossback. And you got out of our socialist hellhole recently. You took a road trip across our state on Highway 2. And so you're going to tell us what it's like outside of the socialist foxhole coming up here in just a few minutes as we cover another electoral controversy out of Washington, D.C., and some summer heat coming to the Northwest, and seafare and more. So will you stay with us, Knut?
You bet.
All right. You stay with us, too, coming up on The Record. KUOW is The Record. I'm Bill Radke, sitting in this hour with Crosscut columnist, the Mossback, Knut Berger. We were just talking about our local election day, and the big story on the national political front is the revelation from the Washington Post that President Trump had a hand, after all, in writing his son's statement about that meeting with a Russian lawyer. And the Washington Post lays out the story, lays out this scenario of the G20 meeting in Germany. The Trump advisors are huddling. They're in meetings, they're walking hallways, they're in conference rooms. The conversation continues on to Air Force One, and they're discussing how are we going to respond to this revelation that Donald Trump Jr. had met with a Russian lawyer during the campaign. And the strategy was settled. Okay, we're going to release a statement. He's going to come clean on this. He's going to release a truthful statement. We're going to get out ahead of this whole story. And apparently, according to the Washington Post, on board Air Force One, President Trump decides, no, we're not going to do all the stuff that we've been discussing for hours. Here's how it's going to go. Take notes. Take dictation.
Yeah.
Take a letter. And the Post uses the phrase personally dictated, a statement in which Trump Jr. said that he and the Russian lawyer had, quote, primarily discussed a program about the adoption of Russian children, and that this was, quote, not a campaign issue at the time. And of course, ultimately, Donald Trump Jr. would acknowledge that he took this meeting after getting the famous email promising damaging information about Hillary Clinton, and that it explicitly was part of a Russian government effort to help his dad's campaign. So today, the news is that the White House press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, came out and acknowledged that President Trump had a hand in this statement and defended President Trump.
The president weighed in, as any father would, based on the limited information that he had. This is all discussion, frankly, of no consequence.
In fairness, my father did often weigh in based on limited information. So I'll give her that. So that's the news. What do you think of the latest, Knut?
Well, yeah, one would think that somebody would have been able to restrain the president from getting involved, because now, you know, having admitted that he was involved in drafting this letter, and that there were large gaps in the account that this this letter, you know, essentially it was a bunch of baloney, you know, really puts them in a situation where now you're going to have not only journalists, but obviously potentially prosecutors or other investigators probing the White House, who knew what when. I mean, this is sort of a classic example of, you know, what we learned as youngins.
You're looking at me, you're looking at my gray hair.
Yeah, as we learned as youngins during Watergate,
yeah.
The cover-up is fraught with danger, right?
That's
often worse than the crime.
It's so fascinating that a lot of people around Trump, including Trump, are saying that he's innocent as a lamb, that he knows that he didn't collude with the Russians to throw the election, and therefore he can what he needs to do is put this political witch hunt down so that he can get on with being a great president. And what I keep hearing from commentators right and left, I keep following this, is people who've been there say, you've got to seal off the White House. The last thing you do is open up that I'm opening up the fly on a tent. Because I'm camping this season,
oh,
right?
Okay.
You don't open up, because the camel will stick its nose in. So that you are opening, it's like you're turning on a giant vacuum cleaner that sucks in all these investigations right into where you don't want it, which is the White House, and that's what Trump, even if he's quote-unquote innocent, is getting wrong at his own expense.
Yeah, you were talking about mosquitoes, and I was envisioning one of those Ebola rooms,
Yeah.
Everything's, and you put the president in a hazmat suit.
Right, president in a bubble.
He's incapable of wearing one or staying on track, and he has this very large ego that thinks he can solve every problem with his blarney.
Does any part of you feel empathy with, let's say that this is true and we don't know, if it's a naive president innocently bumbling around trying to look good? I mean, that's what he's gotten elected, and he was a TV star, and et cetera, et cetera. Just trying to look like a winner, not knowing what he's doing, and he is ending up getting caught in all this legal trouble.
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends on how you define innocent, but I think I think he's really inept and inept at understanding what the context he is in. And just as you say, I mean, that he has responsibilities and vulnerabilities he's just insisting on being Donald Trump no matter what. And, what worked in the New York real estate world is not what works in the kind of government that we have. And so I think he's just like a bull in a china shop, and he's unwilling, his learning curve is pretty flat.
Well, we're going to get out of the bubble and get into, you get into Trump land faster than you think when you take Highway 2, as you taught us. One final word on from Trumpville. I just saw come across the wire that Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, says the Trump campaign could not have colluded with Russia because the team was too dysfunctional and disorganized to coordinate with a foreign government. So now you know. So I bring up Trumpville because I had some delicious cherries again. I've been eating so many cherries this summer. And yesterday we picnicked by the pool. And by the way, I'm a Bing cherry guy. What about you? Rainier?
Oh, I like them all. Yeah, no, the Rainiers are really great. I love them because they're first usually.
Yeah, they're first.
They're the early cherries, and they remind you what cherry goodness is.
They fool you because a delicious red apple is less tart than the kind of lighter red and yellowish apples.
Mm-hmm.
But the Bing cherries are more tart than the Rainier cherries.
Yes. And the thing is that some of the Bing cherries that you eat are probably not Bing cherries, because there are a lot of cherries that look like Bing cherries, but they come later in the season.
Oh.
And so they grow different varieties. This is one thing I learned in Cherry Land.
Yes. We're going to explain this is why we're talking about cherries, because you went to Cherryland. One more fact that you might want to know. I thought maybe, because I think of cherries as being from Washington State, I thought maybe Bing cherries were named after Bing Crosby, who went to, did he go to Gonzaga? Or he was from
Spokane. He lived in Spokane.
Besides,
he was from
Tacoma.
Yeah.
But actually, now you know, the Bing cherry was created as a crossbred by a horticulturalist from Oregon and his Manchurian Chinese foreman, who was named Ah Bing. Ah Bing immigrated from China in the 1850s, worked as a foreman in the orchards, went back to China in 1889, and could never get back into the States because of the Chinese Exclusion Act.
No.
But the horticulturist...
That's actually a really interesting story.
Yeah.
Never heard that.
Yeah. Bing cherry, named after Ah Bing. So now, why were you going to Cherryland, if you will?
Well, so the editors at Crosscut decided that it would be a good idea. We've been talking about this since the election. We've done a couple of things, getting out of the blue bubble and getting out into the rest of the state and talking to people and what life is like outside the socialist hellhole. And yeah. Crosscut sent me and Matt Mills McKnight, a wonderful photographer, for us. And we decided to follow Highway 2. It's also called the High Line. It's the northernmost U.S. highway that crosses the continent, goes all the way to Michigan, then hops over the Great Lakes and shows up again in New England.
Mm-hmm. Stevens Pass, is that
and,
highway
yeah,
too?
Yeah, goes Stevens Pass. Yeah. So it goes in Washington State. It basically goes from Everett to Newport, which is on the Idaho border in Ponderay County, north of Spokane. And we just thought it's a wonderful. It's not like I-90. It's not like jammed with cars. You've got two-lane blacktop. Mm-hmm. You go through just about every ecosystem, you know, that we have: Pine Country, Cascade Country, River Valleys, Dry Falls. I mean, all kinds of Columbia Country, orchards, farms. And along the way, we did a series of stories. And when you mentioned one of the first things that we, were intrigued by was the voting pattern in the Skykomish Valley and mainly in the Sultan Gold Bar area, where we learned from Ben Anderstone, who's a wonderful political consultant who'd done a lot of voter analysis, that had one of the largest concentrations of what they call Obama-Trump voters in
right.
the state. So. And there you have, kind of...
Because we know the Puget Sound counties went Hillary Clinton.
That's right.
But you don't have to go very far. This is Snohomish County.
Right. You're in Snohomish County. You're not that, not that far outside of Everett. And interestingly, it turns out there are a fair number of kind of... I call them deadheads for Trump. It's basically kind of, blue-collar, hippie... voters who, I guess, just did not like Hillary.
And do like legal marijuana.
And do like legal marijuana. And that was one of the interesting things that we ran into there, too, was there's literally, people were talking about, the spotted owl really hurt our economy and closed the mills. And then we actually went to an old mill that's now a marijuana shop and processing plant and grow facility. So... these old timber jobs are shifting into something else.
You crossed the mountains. You went to Cherryland. You went to Applet and Cotlet land.
Yes.
I want to skip over those for a moment
sure.
because you also met a cattle rancher in Davenport, Washington, who we have on the line with us.
Oh, great.
Dave Hubbard, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you.
Did you like Canute as much as he liked you?
Yeah, I did enjoy talking to him.
What'd you talk about?
Oh, geez. Fires that we have, cattle ranching this day and age, and people in general as far as agriculture goes. We cover a lot of those topics. And then Harry Tracy also, the outlaw that actually, he died on our place.
Right, the famous outlaw about 100 years ago. You mentioned fire, and that Canute drew an interesting line for me as a reader that your fire troubles... or sometimes get linked up with some of the rules coming out of Olympia and Washington, D.C. that frustrate you. Is that right?
Yes, we've got probably in the last 15 to 20 years, we've had a tremendous amount of government buyout of local farmers and ranchers that they've bought the ground and for mitigation of sharptail and sage grouse and... the policies that they use on some of that ground where they have, especially where you have gained farmer ground where they absolutely don't do any grazing, has built such a fuel load in our county that when a fire gets started, it's really hard to get stopped. And I understand, they're trying to go with the best science, but I can tell you the birds were here a long, long time ago when there was cattle here too. So there's other problems, and it's not just cattle. And you build up so much fuel over here that when we do get a fire, it can be pretty traumatic. We lost half the ranch, which is 6,000 acres, in 08 to a fire that swept through here that we could not stop. And we're in a fire season right now, and it can be a little spooky.
Yeah. Were you a Trump voter, Dave?
I was a I voted for Trump for the people I thought he would put into office. Let me say that.
Mm-hmm. How's that going so far? From your point of view?
I like the people that he's put in for the Bureau of Land Management because I work a great deal with them, and I'm extremely excited about who he put in for ecology. I do like some of the people he's putting in.
Canute, you got out of your bubble. What did you learn from Dave, rancher out in Davenport?
Well, I learned a lot of things on that short time I spent there. And, one of them was just hearing the on-the-ground perspective of a rancher, somebody who has to abide by a lot of government rules, some of them good, some of them bad. But it was good to get some of the detail about how that worked. And the most striking thing that day was that we were out there talking with Dave about fire danger, and he was telling us about some of the risks and concerns that he had. And unbeknownst to us, a fire was smoldering in the range right adjacent to, some of his land, and it was a lightning strike, and it turned into a wildfire. We came back after we had left. We came back and went out to the fire to actually see it taking place. And it was interesting. It was one of those conversations where somebody says, well, I'm warning you, there's a lot of fire danger here, and here's why. And then poof, there's a fire. So it was a real education, I think, in seeing how that. We talked to some, wheat ranchers too, and orchardists and others about what their issues are. And I think one of the things many of them feel about is that we just don't understand the way of life, the business, the kind of day-to-day struggles. And one thing that comes through is that, a lot of these people, it doesn't take much to bring, it's not just a job, it's their life, it's their family's life, and it doesn't take much to bring that all down. As Dave said, he survived a fire once before. He's right to have those concerns.
Dave, how close to that fire do you now?
Well, the fire that we did have actually touched onto our ground, but our local volunteer fire department got that one out that was next to my place. And next to some of my grazing ground that's a mile or so from my house, it burned probably 300 or 400 acres before they got that stopped. And I got to say that our volunteer fire departments are the ones that get these fires out, and we've got to find a way to help fund those departments and get better equipment in there, because them guys really do the work.
Sounds like you don't have as much time as a newspaper columnist does to get out of your bubble and visit Seattle.
Well, I think it was 2 years ago when I was over there. I have a brother-in-law over there and a sister-in-law, and I do enjoy going over there, but trying to get out of here is a little tough sometimes.
Right. How do you experience being in the Seattle bubble? What's that like for you?
Well, I actually, I don't enjoy the traffic. It's a little overwhelming for me, but I do enjoy the eclectic places you can go and eat and just the different things you see. I mean, it's something new. I do enjoy seeing that.
Well, good luck with everything, with the cattle and with the fire and the weather. How hot's it going to get in Davenport this week?
Well, it's supposed to hit 100, and we're right at probably 97 right now.
97 now, yeah. It's supposed to hit 100 in parts not far from Seattle, in like near Tacoma.
Yeah, it's going to be one of those scorcher summers, I'm afraid. And of course, we have a huge fuel load, so let's hope that we don't get a dry lightning fire over here.
Exactly. Last question. Does everybody have air conditioning in Davenport?
Well, I don't know, but I sure hope so.
Yeah. Dave, good to talk with you.
Thank you.
Thanks for visiting. Cattle rancher in Davenport, Washington, Dave Hubbard. And Canute, I asked Dave about air conditioning because that's something that, again, you and I have lived here a while, and that was really people who live in Seattle didn't have air conditioning that I knew of. And I was reading, you and I both read this story about how the modern apartments in Seattle now, it's much more expected that you'll have AC.
That's right. The air conditioning is sort of the new granite countertops.
Which we feel is borderline immoral.
Yes.
We bonded over this.
I mean, of all places, you'd think that Seattle has so much natural air conditioning that we wouldn't need the other stuff. But it's Dad's definitely on the upswing.
I mean, I really did feel that way. I feel kind of snobbish when I say it out loud, but I have had this feeling that it's hot here so rarely and so not much, you know, and I actually was a little kid in Omaha, Nebraska, and that you tough it out, you sweat it out, and you don't build this infrastructure of Freon around yourself for a few days a year, and that you're pretty wimpy if you do.
Yeah, I grew up in with the same values. You know, my mother, she grew up in Wisconsin, which was hot and humid in the summer. She just disdained air conditioning. You know, open windows, get a cross breeze, sleep naked.
Yeah,
I mean, just, you know, dress in layers, and then you peel off the layers, and sometimes you got to get way down. But you know, one thing that somebody pointed out to me, because I wrote an anti-air conditioning column some time ago, and but somebody pointed out, and I thought this was valid, that with more and more people living in apartments, they don't have some of the things that the single family homeowners
and
whatnot used to have in terms of being able to open windows on opposite ends of the house,
get the cross breeze,
yeah. And that kind of thing. So. But I also think it's something where a lot of people are bringing their desire for air conditioning because they have lived in places where it was required.
Yeah.
Or maybe they're anticipating global warming getting really, really, really bad.
Right. That's part of why they moved here. I've heard that. We have climate refugees, supposedly.
But yeah, part of me is like, okay, you need it. Maybe you need air conditioning 3 or 4 days a year, really? Mm-hmm. I mean, can't you just tough it out?
Can we feel superior?
Yes.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
And we're both naked right now, so it's not like we're not walking the walk. We asked on Facebook, we asked you how you handled the heat. Eric says, I like this. I properly insulated my house.
Oh, well, yes.
Well done, Eric.
Very good.
Mm-hmm. Emma is moving operations to the nearest mall. Marty says that he's working on on airplane testing in Yuma, Arizona, where it's 108 degrees. On the airplane yesterday, it was 130 degrees. And Marty writes, I'm not saying that was hot, but I did watch two hobbits walk on board and drop a ring down into the electronics bay of the plane. I'm not sure I'm following that completely, but I'm guessing that's pretty hot. That's Middle Earth hot or something.
Exactly. Very hot.
Mm-hmm. We got some good ideas from Facebook. You know, you can wear a wet shirt. You can jump in the sound. You can move around slow. You can stay indoors. You can hang out in the basement. I also heard about putting your sheets in the freezer, which I had never thought of as a child. I don't know why my...
Yeah, there you are. You can, you know, get the beer cans out and roll them on your cheeks and your forehead.
Yeah.
You know, those, you know, Rainier tall boys.
That's right, kids.
Get you cooled down.
Yes.
Bring out the Rainier. Don't drink them.
Just
roll in them.
And don't, you wouldn't do this anyway, right? You wouldn't leave a baby or a dog inside of a car, but the Suquamish Police Department issued a statement and said, quote, we will not dilly-dally waiting for you to return, nor will we waste time trying to open the doors using our unlock equipment. If the child is sweating or the dog is panting, we're breaking your window instantly, rescuing the innocent, and charging you with the maximum offenses allowed by law. So that's in Snoqualmish. It's a good advice for all of us.
Yeah, there you go.
One last story. I have a friend. It's very similar. A friend of mine whose family lives in Maine, and where they probably, a lot of people don't have air conditioning, right? Because it's Maine. And maybe how you feel, you and I feel around here. And this friend of mine went back and visited his parents a couple of summers ago, and there was no air conditioning, and he was suffering. It was so hot in this house in Maine. He was sweltering. He finally gave up. Mom, Dad, where's the fan? You don't have a single fan? He gave up and went to get a fan, which in this is rural Maine. He drove, you know, 60 miles, whatever, to buy a fan, brought it back to the house, and survived the rest of his trip. And the following summer, he said, they invited him out, and he said, no thanks. No, I'll skip this one, Mom and Dad. But his sister went to visit the parents. So when she came back, he said, how was the visit with Mom and Dad? And she said, oh, my God, it was obnoxious. It was so hot. And get this, they only had one fan. 100 degrees or so coming up later this week. They say what I saw was in Lakewood, and I think Gig Harbor, it might actually hit triple digits later this week. On the very week of, by the way, of Sea Fair, so you get to swelter and roar on the same week. We're going to talk about Seafair and Seahawks when we come back on The Record with Knute Berger. On this election day in the Northwest, we're doing something a little different today, spending the whole hour with our favorite Mossback crosscut columnist, Knute Berger. A couple things that might surprise you about Knute: huge Seahawks fan and a big Blue Angels fan as well. So let's touch on those before our ends. First of all, Seahawks tickets went on sale this week, single game tickets. You have your season tickets, I assume.
Well, no, I don't have season tickets.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, no, I have friends that have season
tickets. Oh, that even better. Okay. But the level of fandom, I just want to know. Like, this week, a coworker had to tell me that Cam Chancellor had signed a 3-year contract extension. You already knew about that?
Yes, about... I don't know, 7:30 this morning, I skipped into the bedroom to inform my wife that Cam Chancellor was going to be a Seahawk for the next 3 years for $36 million.
Yeah, that's another level beyond knowing what the Seahawks record
well,
is.
And it's even
the contract extension.
Yeah, and even better, she enjoyed hearing the news.
She was glad?
She was glad,
well,
yeah.
Good. Glad or glad for you?
No, she was both.
Okay. You're a couple of fans.
Both.
So I wondered how you feel. The big headline last week was that a study of brains. This is going to get dark. A study of brains from deceased NFL players found CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, brain damage, in something like 97% of the brains tested. Now, first of all, that was the only headline I had heard. I hadn't realized that relatives of the players may have submitted their brains to the study because they thought they noticed clinical symptoms. So it's not random.
Right.
It's not a random study of NFL players. Yeah. But still, I was a big Seahawks fan when I was about through college. And then I grew up, Knute. but I did wonder how a compassionate, thoughtful guy like yourself reacts when you're buying tickets to a game, a gladiator game, where you can feel pretty sure that somebody's going to get brain damage.
Well, or otherwise damaged.
Football
is a brutal sport. I've witnessed some terrible injuries to the Seahawks, but
you love them, you know, right? If you love Russell Wilson, how do you buy that ticket?
Yeah. No, you buy that ticket because those guys, I think, know the risk they're taking. They're playing with great passion. And also, you know, I'm encouraged that the Seahawks in particular, other teams are doing this as well. I mean, they are modifying the game and how it's played to minimize those brain injuries. And, you know, and I think the NFL...
How, you mean they're getting better equipment?
Well, there's better equipment, but
bubble
also
helmets?
Better techniques.
Tackling techniques,
kind of,
yeah.
Yeah, and then the Seahawks have been employing these different kinds of leveraging techniques, so there's not head-to-head combat, or, you know, combat.
You don't stick them with your helmet. You don't go neck first.
Right. You can't do some of that. It's against the rules, but, you know, it's difficult to control everything at the high speed, but they're training the athletes. So as more is learned, the sport, I think, is getting smarter and smarter about playing and adjusting the rules and adjusting the equipment. That study that you quoted, I mean, I was shocked by the number. And as you say, it wasn't a random thing. But, you know, the fact that they found such a high percentage of the brain injury suggests that a lot more research needs to be done to figure out, you know, what the risk levels really are. And one of the places there seems to be more kind of consensus is especially they have to be careful about how young people are when they start playing football.
You know, that's true. It's not just injuries sustained in the NFL, right? These people have been playing since Pop Warner football when they were kids.
Yeah, if you have kids playing tackle football or, you know, with heavy contact when they're 10 years old, you don't know, you know, at what point is the damage occurring and what kind of time frames and what, you know, so they need to know a lot more. And I'm all for them spending some of their vast profits on that kind of thing and taking it very seriously. But it's a violent game. I find it highly entertaining and exciting in part because there are levels of risk and violence that make it exciting. And that probably makes me a barbarian. And you can call me that.
You're a barbarian.
Yeah. Okay.
You know what else is exciting and dangerous? Hydroplane racing. And I actually don't know how dangerous Blue Angels stunt flying is. It looks awfully dangerous, but I haven't compared their safety to other professions. But you're a seafarer. You definitely were a seafarer fan when you were a little mossback.
Well, yes. When I was a baby mossback, we actually lived, you know, within walking distance of Lake Washington. So we and also where the hydroplane pits used to be at Mount Baker Beach there. So I have dim memories of that.
And I should tell people it's Seafair weekend. It's always Seafair summer, all summer long.
Right,
but this is the big
first weekend in August.
Yep.
Is when the races happen and that kind of thing, and the Blue Angels come. And you know, as a kid, I had a bike with a wooden hydroplane behind it. We had organized races in our...
You would drag it, you tied a string with a hydroplane on...
You'd make a wooden hydroplane, you tie it on a string.
You'd make it yourself.
Yeah, on the back of your bike. Your dad would teach you how to use the bandsaw and everything, and you'd paint it up and put decals on it and that kind of thing. And then you'd take it out. We had very organized races in Mount Baker, where I lived.
Would you sink lead into the body of the hydroplane to make it go faster?
Very interesting that you would say. There was a whole strategy to putting lead weights on the nose of it to keep the nose down so the hydroplane wouldn't flip on the curves. And I knew a kid who actually built a trap door in the nose of his hydroplane, and he would pour sand into it, and he could control the level of weight on the front. And this is, you know, this guy's like 12 years old or 11
years
old.
Was this Bill Gates?
Yeah, exactly.
Because I know you went to Lakeside, too.
It's a very smart kid. No, this was not Bill Gates.
Okay.
But anyway, so I was into Bill Muncie and the hydroplane races of that kind of late 50s, up to the mid 60s kind of thing. But, you know, I lost interest in it like most people. I mean, you know, it's a big event. It's a Seattle tradition, but... you know, boat racing is kind of dying, and as a sport, and
they're quieter now, aren't they?
Hydroplanes are quieter and they're safer. See, it's unlike football. They made adjustments because, you know, these hydroplane. There was a time when hydroplane drivers had like the same risk of dying as astronauts, like in the 1960s. It was like it was not a sport for people who lived long, though some did, but. Anyway, but I can't tell you the last time I went to a torchlight parade, probably 30 years ago. It's not like I'm embraced the whole Seafair thing, but I do love the Blue Angels.
Well, yeah, that's what I want to ask you about. You go on KOW, Facebook, all we have to do is say Seafair, and you will get I Hate the Blue Angels.
Yeah.
But you're okay. You're good with them still.
I love it.
They're military. They're right.
That's
they're
fine.
They're harm
I'm
the environment.
I'm not anti-military. I'm, you know,
they're annoying.
They cause traffic jams. To me, it's like you know, high tech acrobatics. I think what they do is amazing, and I love the fact that they, in the part of the town that I live in, they fly so low you can almost. You know, you wave at the pilots as they're coming over upside down, you know. It's something I look forward to every summer. But
you look forward to distracting the pilots as they're moving at that rate of speed?
Yeah, I'm sure that...
With your waving?
Whoa, who's the hairy guy down there? Oh, oops. Crash. Yeah, no, I don't think they're worried.
Okay.
But anyway.
Nothing you would change about Seafair. You either love it or you should.
Well, no, that's not true. I can't stand the Seafair pirates. I can't stand the Seafair clowns.
What's wrong with the pirates?
They're creepy.
Uh-huh.
You know?
What's creepier, pirate, Seafair pirate, Seafair clown?
You know, it's kind of a close call, but the clowns are creepy. I don't like clowns in general, so the clowns are probably creepier. And I had a math teacher who was a Seafair clown, and he was a real jerk. So
I had the king of Seafair in here, John Roderick, yesterday, and the queen, Queen Alcyone came with him.
Oh, there you go.
So I fear angering the... monarch.
I wouldn't. Yeah, angering the Seafair court. You know, that's it's like a Game of Thrones
indeed
type of thing.
Well, the biggest traffic day is usually Thursday. They've got the two practice sessions. This is your public service announcement. If you don't know about the Blue Angels, they're not just loud and thrilling or galling, but they practice. Why don't they practice someplace far away? By the way. And then come here and then blow our minds. Because we've seen them for days by the time they come here and do their official runs.
Yeah, well, they have to get used to, all those bodies of water have different conditions.
Yeah.
You have to learn.
Okay. All right. I want them to live. But they have the on Thursday, the 9:45 session, and then they have a 1 o'clock session, and basically it's always jammed. It's either right before the Blue Angels are flying, or it's during, or it's right after, and another one's coming up, and I-90's closed, and everything else jams up, and enjoy that.
I've always thought the way to revitalize Seafair is that there needs to be some stake in it. Like, each boat represents a particular neighborhood in the city, and neighborhood grants are tied to, like, how they finish. You know, so people will go out there, and it's like, yeah, go Roosevelt.
Right.
Oh,
fighting Southeast.
Rainier Valley, we got to win.
Right.
It's one of those things where I don't think anybody feels a local stake in it in that same way. So it needs a clan element or a neighborhood competition element.
Tribal kind of, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Something more like that. And I think it would become very popular.
Baby needs a new drop-in community center. Let's go. All right. Finally, are you going to the eclipse in a few weeks? Because if you are, I'm sure you're making your plans now, which is already too late.
I'm going to actually be out of the country in a place where there is no eclipse. So I'm saying, yeah, I'm going to be.
Is that by design?
I'm going to be in Kazakhstan when the eclipse is.
Why are you
here,
going to Kazakhstan?
So, there's a World's Fair in Kazakhstan.
Do you go to all the World's Fair? Because you wrote a book about the Space Needle?
Well, no, I've been a World's Fair buff for longer than that. This will be my 10th World's Fair, yeah.
Well, if you were here, you could head south, because the total eclipse, totality, is going to be across a swath of the United States, including the state of Oregon, parts of it. And are you sad you're going to miss it?
Yeah, I am kind of. I have lots of
Would
friends.
You go if you were here?
That's a good question. Probably. I've heard enough about it, but I've been kind of entertained by the way people who I've talked to who are going, everybody seems to be like they're preparing for the apocalypse, you know. It's like, oh, you got to make sure to bring your own water, bring your own gas. There're going to be mobs down there.
Right.
People are going, you know, the traffic will be terrible. It's
so, sounds fun.
Yeah, great. Plus they paid $900 for a yurt, you know.
So. Yeah, it's they're making it out to be the apocalypse that our ancestors thought it was thousands of years ago.
That's true. But no, I think it's going to be a really cool thing. I've heard a lot about it. It sounds exciting. I'm sorry to miss it.
Don't put on a fake sunglasses. They're actually phony eclipse glasses.
That just, you know, if you have any faith in human nature, there it goes.
That's not right.
Fake sunglasses for the eclipse.
Knut Berger is the Mossback at Crosscut, and one of our favorite people to spend time with. Thanks for spending the hour with us today.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
And thank you for tuning into The Record on Twitter at KUOW. It's KUOW Seattle. We'll see you tomorrow. Election results.